Right.
So I second the universe.
Okay, so this is the moment you've all been waiting for. Finally, we get to meet Susie. So, Susie is a remarkable type of symmetry. It's remarkable because it relates particles which spin at different rates. So all the symmetries that you know, all the ones that have been established at least, just relate particles of the same spin. So proton to neutron by isospin, different colors of quarks, they all have the same spin. Neutrinos to electrons via electroweak SU2 and so on. So supersymmetry is something completely novel, and for that reason I find it particularly fascinating. You can compare particles to ballet dancers that pirouette at different rates, and the remarkable thing about supersymmetry is that they relate them all together. Now, supersymmetry was discovered by mathematical physicists around 1970, and I think for a decade or so it remained pretty much a mathematical curiosity. It became of interest to phenomenologists such as myself when it was realized that it could actually have a practical use in terms of stabilizing the electroweak mass scale. And this has to do with cancelling out those quadratic loop divergences that I mentioned previously, and I'll discuss that in more detail later in this lecture. However, it's also been realized that it could have a bunch of other phenomenological applications as well. For example, it would help unify the fundamental forces. I'll discuss this also in more detail in a moment, but if you take the values of the SU3, SU2, and U1 couplings as measured, for example, at LEP, and if you extrapolate them to high energies without supersymmetry, then they don't quite unify. But in supersymmetry, and they unify beautifully. Another nice feature of supersymmetry is that you can actually calculate the mass of the Higgs boson. I'll explain later on why that is the case. The good news is that it actually predicts a light Higgs boson. So in the first lecture, we discussed the fact that the precision electroweak data apparently favour Higgs boson weighing less than about 130 GeV, and that's exactly what supersymmetry would predict. And moreover, this is particularly dear to my heart, in many supersymmetric models, the lightest supersymmetric particle is stable, and it could provide dark matter, which is beloved of astrophysicists and cosmologists. So, plenty of nice reasons for getting interested in supersymmetry. Although, again, to paraphrase Feynman, if you had one really good reason, you wouldn't need to quote four. Okay, so I would like to give a little bit of a historical background to all this, which I will go over later, perhaps in a little bit more detail. So, back even before I started becoming a graduate student, people were trying to unify the sorts of internal symmetries like isospin and flavour SU3 with Lorentz symmetry. And there was a real big industry of this in the 1960s. So the stuff that we remember from the 1960s, things like the Higgs mechanism, the Weinberg's alarm model, people were not paying attention to. They were trying to do this. Until in 1967, Coleman and Mandula proved that it was impossible. And I'll try to give some flavour of their proof a little bit later. Now, then it was, shortly afterwards, that, as I mentioned, the mathematical physicists came along and figured out how to do it, how to circumvent the Coleman-Mandula no-go theorem. And the way to do this is that previously people have been thinking conventionally in terms of bosonic symmetries. So they've been trying to get some bosonic charges which would generalize over SU3, for example. But what a bunch of people did was show that you could extend Lorentz and Poincaré symmetry if you used fermionic charges, i.e. charges which change the spin. So Goldfarb and Lichtman did this. At around the same time, Nevers, Schwartz and Vermond did it in two dimensions. Interestingly enough, what they were trying to do was to extend string theory, which had just recently been discovered, and was at that time considered to be a theory of strongly interacting particles. They tried to extend it to include baryons as well as mesons. I would say that the first real supersymmetric field theories in four dimensions were written down in 1973. So there was one which was sort of a somewhat bizarre curiosity by guys called Volkov and Akerlof, and they had this idea that you could make a non-linear theory in which the neutrino was in some sense the Goldstone fermion of supersymmetry, and that might describe neutrinos. Well, that idea doesn't work. Neutrino interactions don't agree with such a hypothesis. The real breakthrough was by Wesson Zimino, who showed how you could write down renormalizable, i.e. calculable, supersymmetric field theories in four dimensions. Now, as I said, this still remains somewhat of a curiosity for about a decade, until this idea came up that you could use supersymmetry to stabilize the electroweak mass gap. So let me just describe how that comes about. So this problem comes by several different names. In fact, historically, the first name by which this was called was the hierarchy problem. And simply stated, the hierarchy problem is why is the electroweak scale, MW, so much smaller than the Planck scale, which is the scale at which gravity would naturally become the same strength as the other interactions. So that's about 10 to the 19 GeV. Now you can, you might say, well, you know, the hierarchy problem sounds a little bit abstract. Why should I care about the hierarchy problem? Well, you can rephrase it in a different way. The weak interactions are characterized by G Fermi, 1 over mw squared, and that's much stronger than G Newton. G Newton is 1 over m Planck squared, by definition. And so, if you like, the hierarchy problem can be rephrased as saying, why are the weak interactions so much stronger than the gravitational interactions? Or alternatively, you can rephrase it again, and ask yourself, why is it that in atomic physics you can neglect the Newton potential? The Newton potential between two particles in an atom is given by the masses of the particles, let's say m electron times m proton, divided by m Planck squared, relative to the electric charge squared. So this hierarchy problem is certainly an extremely profound problem. If we thought that we could understand why and how there was this hierarchy of mass scales, I think we'd really feel that we've made a great step forward in understanding the way that nature works. Well, of course, supersymmetry does not solve the hierarchy problem. What does supersymmetry do? Let's suppose that some smart person, maybe somebody sitting in this room, has solved the hierarchy problem and has found a theory in which MW is 10 to the minus 17 of the Planck mass. So then the rest of you should ask that smart ass, what happens if I calculate loop corrections to your theory? And if that theory does not have supersymmetry, then I guarantee to you that when you challenge that person to calculate loop corrections, she will find that they are quadratically divergent. So you're going to get shifts in the mass of the Higgs, and therefore also by extension the W, which are of order lambda squared, where lambda is the cutoff up to which your friend's theory is supposed to work. And of course, if your friend really thinks that she has a solution for hierarchy problem, she thinks it works all the way up to M Planck, and so I can stick in lambda equal to M Planck there, and I'm going to get, you know, an effing big contribution to the mass of the Higgs. Now, the place where supersymmetry comes in is because it cancels out systematically those quadratic corrections. And it replaces the quadratic divergence, lambda squared, by the difference between boson and fermion mass squares, where the bosons and fermions here are bosons and fermions with the same internal quantum numbers. So, as I said, this is not a solution to the hierarchy problem. It doesn't tell you why Mw is much smaller than M Planck. But it does tell you that if you have a theory in which Mw is at the input level much less than M Planck, and if you accompany that with supersymmetry at the TV scale, then you can be sure that that hierarchy will be maintained. So let's look in a little bit more detail at some typical loop diagrams. So here I've written down a couple. This is a fermion loop, and this is some generic scalar, or more generally boson loop, which you might want to, or you might need to, calculate the corrections that they give to the mass squared of the Higgs. And indeed, you'll find that each of them is quadratically divergent. You've got a d4k from the momenta, you've got a 1 over k for that propagator, 1 over k for that propagator, 1 over k squared. Here you've got a d4k and a 1 over k squared for that propagator. So each of those diagrams is individually quadratically divergent. So here they're displayed explicitly. So for the diagram on the left, there's a factor of y Fermi squared, that's the coupling which appears there, squared, times lambda squared. And on the right, we've got a quartic coupling, which I call here lambda s, which also gets the lambda squared. So you look at that and you think, well, yes, and so. So you notice that they have opposite signs. And this is a completely general feature of fermion diagrams and boson diagrams. The basic Feynman rules tell you that you're always going to get a relative minus sign. So, bingo! You cancel out the leading quadratic divergence if you have this particular relationship between the scalar coupling and the fermion coupling squared. And at first sight, you might think, well, that's a sort of odd thing to postulate. But in fact, that is precisely what happens in a supersymmetric theory. And a little bit later on, I'll try to give you at least some flavour of how it is that in supersymmetry, this connection between the scalar and the fermion coupling arises. So you might say, well, that's all very nice, but no, little Higgs theory also cancels out the quadratic divergences, so what is the big deal? Well, the big deal is that if you have this relationship, then you're going to cancel out all the quadratic divergences to all orders in perturbation theory. There are other divergences that also cancel, but this is something which, you know, if you impose it at the beginning, it works to all orders in perturbation theory. So this certainly seems like the silver bullet for solving what you might describe as the naturalness aspect of the hierarchy problem. If I make Mw by hand much smaller than M Planck with supersymmetry, it stays there because these quadratic divergences are systematically cancelled. So that was all very well and fine, but what's that got to do with phenomenology? Is there any phenomenological hint that this might be the way the world works? So, one of the hints, as I already mentioned, was provided by the measurements of the SU3, SU2, and U1 couplings at LEP around 1990. So this is a very, very famous plot. You put in the values of these couplings at low energies, you then extrapolate them up to higher energies using the renormalization group. So you've got the asymptotic freedom of QCD, you've got similar logarithmic evolution for the other couplings. And close, but no banana if you don't have supersymmetry. You put in supersymmetry around the TV scale, and hey presto, couplings converge. So that was kind of impressive for many people when that argument emerged. Now, as I've mentioned, that wasn't the only argument. Another argument which emerged during the course of the 1990s was this argument about the lightness of the Higgs boson. So as time progressed during the 1990s, it became more and more apparent that the Higgs boson exists at all, is presumably fairly light. But it was known that the Higgs boson was predicted in supersymmetry to be relatively light. And this is just one particular calculation that we did a few years ago. I could show many other similar arguments. Why is it that you can calculate the mass of the Higgs boson in supersymmetry? Well, you remember that in the standard model Higgs potential that we had on the first day, there was mu squared and there was little lambda. Little lambda is the quartic self-coupling of the Higgs. Now, in a supersymmetric theory, little lambda is calculable. It's just basically g squared, where g is the gauge coupling. So you know how big little lambda is, and then you go through and you calculate the mass of the Higgs boson. You calculate some gradient of corrections, but that's basically the way it works. So I don't need to emphasize yet again that this is in agreement with the indications from the precision electroweak data. So, lots of reasons to like supersymmetry. And before I get accused of sexism, I should say that I stole this little graphic here from Fabiola Giannotti. So if she thinks it's okay, then I hope you will think it's okay for me to show that picture of Susie. Dark matter in the universe. So the astronomers say that most of the matter in the universe is actually invisible dark stuff that doesn't interact very much. And the lightest supersymmetric particle is tailor-made for this. I will discuss this in more detail later on. In fact, supersymmetry is not the only theory that could predict dark matter at the TeV scale. There are certain variants of extra-dimensional theories, even variants of little Higgs-type theories, which also predict some stable relic particle weighing about a TeV. In fact, there's a very general argument that you could get the right amount of dark matter in a very natural way if you have a particle that weighs the square root of the Planck mass times the temperature of the microwave background, which you will remember is 2.7 Kelvin, and you will remember what a Kelvin is, don't you? So the square root of 2.7 Kelvin times m Planck turns out to be about a TeV. Supersymmetry predicts a stable particle weighing about a TeV, and that could be the stuff that provides the dark matter. Okay, so I mentioned some of the mathematical physicists who discovered supersymmetry in the first place. I'd also like to mention the names of some of the people who realized that supersymmetry could actually be useful. So the people who proved that you had these nice renormalization properties in supersymmetry were Ferraro, Eliopoulos, Wess, and Zamino. Of course, very important to combine supersymmetry with gravity. That's what's called a supergravity theory, and that was discovered by these guys a couple of years later. Several people realized the relevance of supersymmetry to the hierarchy problem. I believe that the first reference, actually, in some summer school lecture notes is due to Maiani, although he didn't follow it up in any way. The person who really pushed the idea very strongly was Ed Witten in 1981. I would claim some partial credit for realizing that this could be the astrophysical dark matter, and also some credit partial for the unification of the gauge couplings. Now, but I'd like to go back a little bit and discuss this Kalman-Bandula catastrophe. It's not really essential to understand what it is, and this is some discussion that took place over 40 years ago, but I still think it's amusing. So remember, these were the guys who, way back in the beginning, proved incontrovertibly that it was impossible to combine internal and Lorentz symmetry. So, what was their argument? Well, they said, well, you know, let's look at the known types of symmetry. We've got symmetries which relate particles of the same spin. We've got Lorentz symmetry, which is generated by a vector charge P mu. Now let's try introducing other bosonic charges. So, well, there can't be another vector charge, because then you'd have two Lorentz symmetries, which, you know, obviously doesn't work. So let's try to imagine that there was a higher spin charge. And so here's the diagonal matrix element of this conjectured higher spin charge, sigma mu nu, which I, just by Lorentz invariance has to be expressed in terms of g mu nu and p mu. Now, this is supposed to be a conserved charge, so if you have a scattering experiment, so you bang particle 1 against particle 2, and you get out particle 3 and particle 4, then sigma mu nu has to be conserved, and that means that the product p mu p nu has to be conserved. But we also know that momentum is conserved, and it's very simple to satisfy yourself that combining these two arguments, the only scattering that's possible is forward scattering. Particles either go straight through each other or they bounce straight back again. So they concluded, no bad karma, no non-trivial scattering is possible. And everybody applauded them. They became famous, well, at least Kalman became famous. Bandula went off and worked for the government. However, there is a crucial assumption in this. And the crucial assumption is that the diagonal matrix element of your charge is non-zero. In supersymmetry, the way that you generalize internal symmetries is not by postulating a bosonic charge, but by postulating a fermionic charge. Fermionic charge necessarily changes spin, so it takes you from spin j to spin j plus or minus a half. The diagonal matrix element vanishes. And so Kalman and Bandula fall by the wayside. Well, I guess that Kalman was a sufficiently well-known mathematical physicist to survive it, but as I said, Bandula went off to work for the US government. Okay, so if we're going to discuss supersymmetry, we're going to need to discuss fermions. So I will discuss fermions a little bit. Those of you who are dyed-in-the-wool hardware people can, you know, go off to sleep for a couple of minutes until we get through this. But anyway, here we go. So it's convenient when you're discussing spinners. Usually when spinners are presented in field theory courses, you talk about four component Dirac spinners. Right. Well, actually, the fundamental building block for spinners can be regarded as two component spinners, two component Weyl spinners. And you may say, well, I know I've got left-handed particles and I've got right-handed particles. And, well, the left-handed particles you can describe by these Weyl spinners and the right-handed particles by their conjugates. And then if you want to make a four-component Dirac spinner, then you would combine together a psi left and a psi right, which would mean one of these Weyls and a conjugate of a Y. Neutrinos are examples of things that you can describe directly in terms of these two-component spinners. You don't need four-component Dirac spinners to describe a neutrino. Two-component spinners is just fine. And that's an example of how it is that these two-component spinners are in some sense more fundamental than the four-component Dirac spinners that you're usually introduced to. Okay, so we're going to be working in terms of these two-component spinners for the time being. So, in terms of these two-component spinners, what is the supersymmetry algebra? Well, at a very simple level, what the supersymmetry algebra does is it changes a boson into a fermion, and it changes a fermion into a boson. But now we're going to drill down a little bit into some of the niceties as to how this happens. So the supersymmetry algebra is written down here. There's a few commutator and anti-commutator relations which you need to have in mind. So it's a symmetry, so the charges must commute with the momentum operator. The most intriguing aspect of the supersymmetry algebra is that the anti-commutator of two of these spinorial charges turns out to be the momentum operator. Now, it's actually a theorem that this is the only way to do it. I will try to give you in a moment some flavor of how this comes about. But this is actually quite a remarkable result, because this tells you that in some sense you can regard supersymmetry as being the square root of a Lorentz transformation. So as I said, there is a theorem that this is the only possible symmetry of the scattering matrix that combines particles of different spins. That was proven by Haag, Lopushansky, and Sonius back in the early 1970s. So, you've got an algebra. Next thing you should ask yourself is, what are the representations of the algebra? So, you've got isospin SU2. What's the simplest representation of SU2? Well, it's an isospin doublet, like proton-neutron or like neutrino-electron. What is the simplest possible representation of the supersymmetry algebra? Well, it's going to have particles of different spins, so the simplest possibility is to have two different spins. And that could be either spin 0 with spin 1/2, and that's what we call a chiral supermultiplet. Or it could be spin 1/2 with spin 1, which is what we call a vector supermultiplet. Now, I'm sure that some smart ass out there is saying, well, what about spin 1 with spin 3/2? A good question. Turns out that the only way you can incorporate spin 3/2 is in a doublet with spin 2, so the graviton and spin 3/2 particle, which we call the gravitino. But I'll come back to that later on. I mean, as far as constructing the normalizable field theories are concerned, these are your basic building blocks: doublets of spin 0 and spin 1/2, or doublets of spin 1/2 and spin 1. Maybe I pause for a second. Are there any questions? Yes. Okay, that has to do with the structure of the Lorentz group, which probably we don't have enough time to discuss, so maybe try to catch me over the weekend, which is something like a non-compact version of SU2 cross SU2. So you've got one index for one SU2 and one index for the SU2. It's not actually SU2 called SU2, but that's a way of thinking about it. Yeah?
Is there anything slightly more intuitive that you could say about the momentum operator being in the algebra? Or you said briefly that the Suzuki transformation was the square root of momentum. I
mind-boggling, right?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe you hold on to that question for a couple of slides, because I tried to give you a little bit of a flavor about how it works. Okay, so let's move on a little bit. So I now wanted to show you the simplest possible supersymmetric field theory. And you may know the character in a play by Molière, who was amazed to discover that he'd been speaking prose all his life. So in the same way, you have been working with supersymmetric field theories all your lives. Well, okay. So if you write down a free boson and a free spin one half fermion, so here is the kinetic term written down for the fermion, perhaps in a somewhat unfamiliar notation, but it's psi bar d slash psi. And here's the kinetic term for a boson, d mu phi, d mu phi star. That is actually supersymmetric. So how do you demonstrate that it's supersymmetric? Well, you make your supersymmetry transformation. So you make a little transformation epsilon. Now, normally when you make an epsilon, that epsilon doesn't have an index on because it's a scalar charge. But here it has a little index on, it has an alpha. So delta phi is epsilon times the boson psi, and that gives you a change in the scalar Lagrangian. The transformation on the boson, and then you get a change in the kinetic term in the Lagrangian. Now you can try to make a change in the fermion. So here comes the little sneaky bit. So a boson field has dimension 1. A fermion field has dimension 3 halves. Okay? When you add up the dimensions in the Lagrangian, you get dimension 4. Okay, so that means that this epsilon here has to have dimension minus 1 half. Okay, so 1 is equal to 3 halves minus 1 half. So now you try to make your transformation on the fermion. Well, that's going to be 3 halves over here. The epsilon has minus a half. So I'm going to need not just 1, but 2 for the dimensionality of the bosonic bit on the right-hand side. So the only thing that you can put here is d nu phi. You can't consistently make a transformation where delta psi is epsilon times phi. It has to be epsilon times d mu phi, and that has to do with the different dimensionalities of the boson and the fermion fields. So, a little exercise that you can do while you're sitting in the bus this afternoon is to verify that with these transformations, when you make transformation on the Lagrangian, it is not invariant. But aren't symmetries corresponding to invariant Lagrangians? No. Symmetries correspond to invariant actions, where actions are the integral over four space of the Lagrangian. And if you compute the variation in the action, then you'll find that it is indeed zero. And you have seen that the composition of two supersymmetric charges, the epsilon acting on the fermion and the epsilon d mu phi, that the combination of these two bosonic charges corresponds to the momentum operator. So, Giovanni, does that help you a little bit? I mean, there must be some incredibly deep and very simple intuitive answer that I could give, but I don't know it. You know it? But anyway, that's the best I can do. Okay, so a free boson plus a free fermion is supersymmetric. Great. But we're not interested in free bosons and free fermions. We're interested in theories with interactions. So let's go through a few examples of theories, supersymmetric theories with interactions. So let's start off by adding to our free boson theory that we had on the previous slide. Let's introduce an effective potential, V, and let's introduce a sort of generalized mass term for the fermion. Okay, so a mass term has two psi's, and in order to get something that looks like a Yukawa interaction, we're going to have something with a function of the phi fields, the scalar fields. And of course, the effective potential is just a function of the scalar fields. So now what happens if you make this sort of epsilon alpha transformation that we had on the previous slide? So you make an epsilon type transformation on this M over here, and you're going to get something which looks like dm by d phi with a product of three psi's coming in. Now, if you think about it, there's no possible way that you could get rid of that, because there's no other variation in the action which is going to give you a product of three psi's. So the only possible answer is that this thing here must vanish. Now, if you've got three psi's, they're fermions, product of three psi's is anti-symmetric. So what this means is that this other term here must be totally symmetric. And the only way to have it totally symmetric is to have the mass being the second derivative of something that we call W, which, to anticipate, is going to be called the superpotential. So in order to make the mass term invariant under the transformation, the mass term has to be related to the superpotential W by a second derivative. Now, that was considering the variation in the mass term. Now you could also consider what happens when you make this little epsilon transformation on the effective potential. So you get this d by d psi with a single psi. So I leave it as an exercise to demonstrate that in order to cancel out that particular variation, the effective potential must also be related to this thing W, and in fact the potential is given by dW by d phi quantity squared. So this is the final form of your effective Lagrangian. You've got the free fermion over here, you've got the free boson over here, and you've got Yukawa interactions and an effective potential which are related to something called W. So the simplest possible form for W would be that it has a trilinear piece and a mass type piece. And if you go through these rules, then you'll find that you're going to get a mass which is the same for the boson and the fermion, mass M, and you're going to get trilinear Yukawa type interaction and a quartic potential interaction. And you will notice that this Yukawa interaction is the quartic interaction is equal to the Yukawa interaction squared. Right? That is exactly what we had a few slides back as a condition for getting rid of the quadratic divergences. Remember, lambda scalar has to be equal to lambda fermion squared to within a factor of 2, and I've lost the factor of 2 somewhere. Well, okay? So, in this simple slide, we see the emergence of this condition that you need in order to get the cancellation of the quadratic divergences. And we see that, in general, if you want to characterize a supersymmetric field theory, you need to invent some trilinear function W, which is like a mnemonic for deriving all the interactions of the theory. Now, that's all well and good, so that might be a prototype for, if you like, generalizing in a supersymmetric way, the Yukawa interactions of the standard model, which have the form psi bar psi Higgs boson. We're also interested in gauge interactions. So what is the supersymmetric form of the gauge interactions? So you remember that the gauge multiplet would consist of a gauge boson of spin 1 and a fermion of spin 1/2. Now, related by supersymmetry, but they would have the same internal symmetry properties. So if the spin 1 particle is an adjoint of SU3, that's a gluon, then the spin 1/2 particle also has to be an adjoint of SU3. They have to have the same internal symmetry properties. So what happens if you add together gauge bosons and adjoint spin 1/2 fermions? The answer is that it's automatically supersymmetric. You don't have to do anything more. It's already supersymmetric. So this is somehow another example of how supersymmetry, in some sense, you feel is lying there all the time. And you know, how was it that it took field theorists 50 years to discover supersymmetry when it was staring us in the face? So what I just said holds true if you have only gauge bosons and only adjoint spin 1/2 fermions. Things get a little bit more gory if you have the gauge interactions of chiral fields, bosons and fermions. And this bit I will not discuss. But the important point to retain is that when you do that, you get quartic interactions for the scalar particles. So one of these quartic interactions I've already introduced, right? This is related to the Yukawa couplings Y, the scalar interaction given by Y squared. Correspondingly, there is a quartic interaction related to the gauge coupling squared. And this is the feature which enables you to predict the mass of the Higgs boson. This is telling you that the quartic coupling of the Higgs theory is related to the gauge couplings and the Yukawa couplings. In the standard model, the most important role is played by the gauge couplings. Okay, so you get a prediction for the Higgs mass, and in fact, at the tree level, the Higgs mass is less than mz. So, this was realized back in the 1980s, and so we supersymmetrists were quite confident, shall we say, that LEP would be able to produce the supersymmetric Higgs boson, because if it weighs less than mz and if you've got a central mass energy of 200 GeV, you're in good shape. Unfortunately, we realized about 1990 that there were radiative corrections to the mass of the Higgs boson, which are perfectly calculable, perfectly meaningful. Unfortunately, they're rather large. So somewhere around 1991, we sort of stuck our hands up to CERN management and said, excuse me, actually, the Higgs boson might actually weigh a little bit more than mz, maybe as much as 130 GeV. So they did buy a little bit more superconducting RF to increase the energy, but not enough. Oh, well. So I've told you everything that you need to know about supersymmetry, maybe even a little bit more, except that, as I mentioned, if you want to have a spin 3/2 particle, you have to couple it to spin 2, and that is actually what happens in supergravity. And in fact, it's another supersymmetric miracle that if you just write down a spin 3/2 particle and couple it to gravity, it's automatically supersymmetric. Okay, that's all you need to know about supersymmetric field theory. Any questions or comments before I move on to do some phenomenology? You're indefatigable, aren't you? I like it.
Is how it's supposed to be this particle aligns? Is it with breaking of supersymmetry?
So
how this Higgs particle or Higgs mass
you have to introduce a Higgs field. The Higgs field cannot be the supersymmetric part of the electron, say, because they have different quantum numbers. The electron, so the electron has lepton number, the Higgs could not have lepton number. So you have to introduce a special Higgs supermultiplet consisting of a Higgs boson and a Higgs fermion or Higgs eno. I'll come back to that in just a sec. Yeah. It's constrained by the gauge symmetries of the theory, but it's not uniquely prescribed by the symmetries of the theory. And so what people normally do is they just write down a supersymmetric version of the standard model. That's what I'm going to do on the next slide. But there are additional interactions, additional terms in W which you could put in, which would violate either baryon number and or lepton number, so so-called R-violating terms. I'm not going to do that in this lecture, but in principle there are these additional terms which are consistent with gauge symmetries. Yeah?
You showed us the property of unification of gauge couplings.
Yeah.
And supersymmetry, it doesn't really stand on. I was wondering how natural is that in supersymmetry? Does it just fall out, or do you have to put some effort into it so they unite it somehow?
You basically don't have to put any effort in. You just the whole idea of phenomenological supersymmetry is that the supersymmetric particles should weigh about a TeV or so. So you just put in supersymmetric particles weighing a TeV or so, and bingo, the lines realign, sort of unify. I will actually discuss that in more detail in Monday's lecture. Okay, so. What is the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model? So as I just said in response to your question, what you basically do is you postulate supersymmetric partners for all the known particles. So lepton plus lepton, quark plus quark, photon plus photino, gluon plus gluino, and so on. One of the little complications in supersymmetry is that you need to have two Higgs doublets. I will explain on the next slide in more detail why you need two Higgs doublets. But believe me, you do, and this means that there is an additional couple of parameters that comes in. One is a coupling mu between the two Higgs multiplets, and another one is the ratio of the Higgs maximum expectation values. Simply stated, there is one Higgs that gives masses to up-type quarks, and another one gives masses to down-type quarks. And the electrons, the charged leptons, those have different maximum expectation values, and the ratio is what we call type beta. Now, supersymmetric theory is in principle relatively simple. There's essentially no free parameters apart from mu and tan beta. The trouble is, of course, that supersymmetry cannot be an exact symmetry. It must be a broken symmetry. And so you have to introduce parameters to break supersymmetry, or you have to invent a theory to break supersymmetry. So there's lots and lots of theories for breaking supersymmetry, but none of them have gained any consensus amongst theorists. So what I'm going to do in these lectures is just put in parameters by hand, scalar masses for the unseen scalar particles, masses for the unseen gauge-eno partners of the gauge bosons, and then there's a couple of other parameters which are not so essential for our discussion. Now, it's often assumed that these supersymmetry breaking parameters are universal, so that every quark and lepton has the same M0, every gauge-eno has the same M1/2, and so on. There's no real strong justification for that. There are some motivations coming from flavor physics, which I will mention at some later point. But this is a little bit of an embarrassment, because if you write down a generic string theory, it's not automatic that you're going to get this sort of universality. But this is convenient when you're trying to do phenomenology. So this scenario that I just described is the so-called constrained minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model. People often refer to this as minimal supergravity. I didn't mention supergravity here at all. If you're going to talk about minimal supergravity, then that introduces the graviton, and that also introduces a relationship for the gravitino mass that actually makes it equal to the scalar mass. So supergravity involves an extra hypothesis, and I won't make that hypothesis in the phenomenology that I'm going to discuss later on. Okay, so why two Higgs doublets? So the reason for this, there's actually two reasons. One reason is that whenever you write down a gauge theory, you have to check that the symmetry is symmetry survives loop corrections. It can have no anomalies, as they're called. Anomalies could arise from when you calculate triangle diagrams like this one here, and if you're not careful with the quantum numbers of the particles going around the loops, then you're going to find that the gauge symmetry gets broken. Now, in the case of supersymmetry, there are new triangle diagrams. So in the standard model, the triangle diagrams cancel out very naturally between the quarks and the leptons. But when you introduce supersymmetry, you introduce diagrams which have Higgsinos going around, and those have nothing to cancel against because the standard model particles already cancelled against each other. So the only way to cancel out the Higgsino diagrams is to make the Higgsinos cancel against each other. So that means you need two Higgs doublets with opposite quantum numbers. There is also a somewhat more subtle point, which is that when you look at this superpotential W that I introduced earlier on, it has to be an analytic function of the superfields, and that means that you can write down things like quark, anti-quark, Higgs, but you can't write down something like quark, anti-quark, anti-Higgs. And so that's why, if you want to give masses to the up-type quarks and the down-type quarks, you need two different Higgs fields with different quantum numbers, and in fact the different quantum numbers are precisely what you need to cancel out that triangle diagram. So, that's a little bit of a technical complication, but of course it's great for you experimentalists because it means that you get a whole shitload of Higgs bosons to look for. And in fact, in the minimal supersymmetric model, there are five Higgs bosons to look for, three neutral ones and two charged ones. So, I introduced a moment back the constrained MSSM, which is the simplest possible way in which you could break supersymmetry. Is it necessarily the only way in which you could break supersymmetry? Could you, for example, imagine that the different flavors of squarks, or the different flavors of sleptons, had different masses? Well, there's several aspects to this. One aspect is, could different, say, quarks with the same charge have different masses? Or should all those squarks have the same quantum numbers? So it's easy to write down little loop diagrams involving these squarks and check that they would give you enormous flavor-violating neutral interactions unless the squarks with the same flavor have the same mass, N0. So, flavor physics, the success of the CKM model is telling us, I think, some people would disagree, but I think they're telling us that different squarks with the same charges must have the same mass. How about squarks with different quantum numbers? Or how about squarks and sleptons? Is there any reason why they should have the same mass? Well, in grand unified theories, yes, they would have the same mass. Of course, we don't know whether any grand unified theory is correct, but at least it's reasonable to at least explore the hypothesis that these different squarks and sleptons have the same mass. On the other hand, there's no particular reason why the Higgs bosons, when you write down your theory, should have the same supersymmetry breaking mass as the scraps and the sleptons. So those could be non-universal, they could be different from the scraps and the sleptons, and that gives rise to something which we call the non-universal Higgs model, or NUHN. And when I get around to discussing phenomenology and experimental constraints on supersymmetry, then I will use as two straw people to compare the CMSSN and at least the simplest version of the NUHN. Now, when I say that these particles might have the same mass, of course I don't really mean that. That would be too simple. What I actually mean is that the particles would have the same mass before the normalization. So what happens is that there is a normalization of the scalar masses and the gauge-Enum masses, which is actually very similar to the normalization of the gauge couplings that you're all familiar with. So asymptotic freedom, you know, SU3 coupling varies. Also, there's a similar variation in the effective masses of the supersymmetric particles. So, if you assume universal input parameters as I just described, then it turns out that the physical gauge-Enum masses are just given by the ratio of the gauge coupling strengths times the input mass. So the same picture that you've seen ad nauseam for the evolution of the gauge couplings, you could also write down for the evolution of the gauge-Enum masses. Scalars, it's a bit more complicated. So this is a picture which illustrates a generic pattern of renormalization. It's a little bit complicated, I apologize for that, should produce a better version. But you see, here over here we've got the gauge-Enums, which start off with a common mass, and the gluino gets heavier, the SU2-yno is lighter, and the bino is the lightest. It's just like the SU3, SU2, and U1 coupling strengths. And then here the scalars starting off with a common mass M0, and well, the squarks get the most renormalization, so the squarks are predicted to be the heaviest, sleptons somewhat lighter. So this is what's written here with these generic normalization effects. The gluino is heavier than the photino and wino, squarks are heavier than sleptons. You'll notice there is one curious feature here, that's these dashed lines. So one of them stays positive, the other one goes negative. What's going on there? Well, that's one of the most beautiful aspects of the supersymmetry phenomenology, that you can get an effective Higgs mass squared, which is initially positive, but is driven negative by the normalization, and when it's driven negative, that gives you spontaneous symmetry breaking. So in other words, in the first lecture, I said that the Higgs mass squared has to be negative in order to get spontaneous symmetry breaking. This is actually a mechanism driving a negative. So this is a little bit more about the renormalization. As I've said, gauge-Enums get renormalized in proportion to gauge coupling strengths. Squarks get larger mass squares than sleptons. Right-handed sleptons have a smaller mass than left-handed sleptons, just because they get less renormalization. And in the scenario which I've described up to now, it's something which we call a scenario with minimal flavor violation, in that there is no additional flavor physics coming from supersymmetry apart from what you get through a normalization, through the Yukawa interactions in CKM. So a little bit more about electroweak symmetry breaking. So here is the way in which a generic scalar mass gets renormalized. So there's two contributions. There's denormalization by the gauge coupling squared and renormalization by Yukawa coupling squared. And they have opposite signs, because one is renormalization by gauge enos and the other one is renormalization by squarks and sleptons, bosons and fermions. Now, what this actually tells you is that the effective mass, let's say the Higgs, increases as you increase the energy scale. Conversely, it decreases as you decrease the energy scale. And it's that decrease, as you decrease the energy scale, which says that you can start off with a Higgs which has a positive mass squared and finishes up at low energies with negative mass squared. So that's what I show here. Here is the Higgs coupled to the up-type quarks, principally the top quark, which has its m squared driven negative. And it was realized back in the 1980s that you could naturally get an electric weak scale of the order of 100 GeV if you put into your normalization group equations a top quark weighing somewhere between 60 and 200 GeV. So at the time, people sort of said, well, that's pretty fucking ridiculous. You know, the top quark couldn't weigh as much as 200 GeV. Give me a break. Well, turns out it does. How am I doing for time? Five minutes. Okay. So let me maybe just briefly discuss the lightest supersymmetric particle and how it could make up the dark matter, and then we'll discuss the actual compilation of phenomenological constraints on supersymmetry at the beginning of Monday's lecture. So, lightest supersymmetric particle. So, this is stable in many models because it carries a conserved quantum number. This conserved quantum number is something called R parity. And R parity is just, there's nothing fancy about it, it's just an algebraic combination of lepton number, baryon number, and spin. So, here it is. So, if you have a theory which conserves spin, well, most theories conserve spin, don't they? If it conserves lepton number, and if it conserves baryon number, then you will automatically conserve R parity. I might say, well, maybe I could come up with a theory with lepton masses. Well, simplest versions of those also conserve lepton number. Maybe I could think of a theory which has baryons decay, or most guts that have baryon decay actually conserve this particular combination of lepton number and baryon number. So again, R parity is conserved. Right, so now, what is your R parity? You may not have realized that you have an R parity, but you've got an R parity. Your R parity is plus one. It's easy to check. You put in the quantum numbers of a quark, or a lepton, or W, you stick them in there, and you always get R parity minus one. So, plus one. Now, you put in a supersymmetric particle. A supersymmetric particle has a spin that differs by half a unit. So you're going to get an extra minus one. So to the extent that a regular particle has R parity plus one, a supersymmetric particle inevitably has R parity minus one. So we've got conserved quantum number, plus one for all regular particles, minus one for supersymmetric particles. So all that means is that particles must be produced in pairs. Now you either produce two gluinos or a gluino plus a squark, like you'll produce four gluinos in the LHC, but you will not produce one gluino, okay? Even number of gluinos. And each supersymmetric particle decays into lighter ones, just so as to carry along the R parity. Well, this means that the lightest supersymmetric particle is stuck, because the lightest supersymmetric particle has R parity and it has no legal decay mode, and so there it is, stable. Now you might say, well, what sort of interactions could this thing have? Could it have strong electromagnetic interactions? think so, because if it did, then it would bind to regular matter and it would make anomalous atoms, which would look like anomalous heavy nuclei, and people have looked for such things, they've never seen them. So the lightest supersymmetric particle does not bind to regular matter, which of course is good news for dark matter, right? Dark matter is exactly what you, the property that you want for dark matter. So you look through your particle data book to figure out which are the weakly interacting candidates to be dark matter. So the first thing that you might think of is a supersymmetric partner of a neutrino. Neutrino has weak interactions. Neutrino would also have weak interactions. However, LEP searches tell us that it has to weigh more than something like 40 GeV, and the direct searches looking for dark matter in the universe then take over and they tell us, well, if it's going to be heavier than 40 GeV, it's going to have to be heavier than multi-TeV. So this neutrino does not look like a good possibility. How about the lightest neutralino? So the lightest neutralino is supersymmetric partner of Z, photon, and Higgs. This is perfectly possible candidate, and in fact, in most supersymmetric models, most supersymmetric phenomenological studies, that's what people assume. It's not necessarily the case. The lightest supersymmetric particle could equally well be the gravitino, the supersymmetric partner of the graviton. So you might ask, well, why is it that people think about neutralinos rather than gravitinos? To my mind, the answer is purely sociological, which is that gravitinos are a nightmare for detection. Well, they're a nightmare for detection as astrophysical dark matter, but they wouldn't necessarily be a problem at the LHC, for example. I don't think there's any problem for detecting gravitino dark matter variants of supersymmetry at the LHC. So how would you actually look for supersymmetry at the LHC or somewhere else? Well, you're looking for production of basically a dark matter particle, actually pairs of dark matter particles, because, as I said, with R parity, supersymmetric particles are always produced in pairs, so you've got a cascade of things down to on each side, the lightest supersymmetric particle. So how do you detect a particle that doesn't interact? Well, you don't see it. What you see instead is everything else in the event. So here's an example of a simulation where you produced a couple of strongly interacting particles. They then decay, producing jets plus missing energy. So here are the jets, and over there is missing energy. So you would look for events in which there is energy missing from the event. Now, you can't measure the longitudinal component of the energy momentum vector, but you can measure the transverse component. So typically what you look for is missing transverse energy. So I compare the search for supersymmetry in the LHC to playing billiards, pool, with some invisible billiard balls. So you fire your cue ball into the triangle of balls at the beginning, balls go all over the place. You would be pretty surprised if the only balls that you could see went to the right and no balls went to the left. Momentum conservation tells you that's equal, and momentum going left and right. So this is an example of how you fired your cue ball and balls went to the right, nothing went to the left, and that would be a signature for supersymmetry. So, I think I'll stop at that point.
Thank you.
two loops cancels, but they are super symmetric loops. So what is cancelling?
Okay, so the standard model Higgs. Let me rephrase that. So as I mentioned, you've got five physical Higgs bosons. So two of them are charged. Okay, so that gives you three neutrals. Now, in most models, the lightest of those neutrals looks very much like a standard model Higgs boson. So for example, in the CMSSM, its couplings are typically identical with that of the standard model Higgs boson, down to the level of 1 or 2%. In the non-universal Higgs models, they can be a little bit different, but CMSSM, basically standard model couplings. Now, in general, this standard model-like Higgs boson is actually a combination of the neutral components of the two Higgs doublets. And that composition depends, for example, on tan beta and on the other parameters of the model. So people who are discussing supersymmetry for homology often introduce some other mixing angle called alpha, great imagination, which describes how these two Higgs doublets mix together, and that characterizes the couplings of this neutral-like Higgs boson. But in general, it's pretty much like that of a standard model Higgs boson. Well, I don't think that's a totally unfair characterization. I think what you're doing is, at each stage you're solving an immediate problem and introducing another problem which occurs somewhat later on. Right. So, if you have the standard model without a Higgs boson, well, how do you break symmetry? You can't just postulate the particles have different masses, because then when you calculate things, you get infinite answers. So you stick in the Higgs boson, you get finite answers. Right? But then, as you implied, then you introduce a new problem, right? Which is what happens when you calculate quantum corrections to the mass of that Higgs boson. So then you introduce. So you're pushing the problem further and further away, so to speak. Now, I would claim that in the past, this sort of thing has worked. Right. So if you think back to the way in which electroweak unification was arrived at, people said, a four fermion interaction doesn't make any sense, so let me introduce a W. Right. Turns out that it's there. That solves a lot of problems, but not all problems. There was a problem with flavor change in mutual interaction. So Glashow, Eliopoulos, and Maiani said, if we introduce this new quark which has this particular mass, then it solves the problem. Now, they didn't have a theory of what the mass of this quark should be. Right? We still don't have a theory for what the mass of the charmed quark should be. But if you put in the charmed quark, then it solves the problem. So I think there are historical precedents for introducing new particles which solve problems only to reveal new ones. But it is true that if you go down this chain of logic, then your question becomes, as you rightly identified, what is the origin of supersymmetry breaking? And that is potentially a very profound problem which has to do with the nature of supergravity, superstring theory, and so on. But at least you've fixed up a whole bunch of other problems along the way. And you've got something which enables you to calculate things at the LHC and you get sensible answers. Whether they're right or not is a different story. Well, if you think back to my first lecture, I had these various different sectors of the standard model. I had the gauge interactions, I had the Yukawa interactions, and I had the Higgs sector. And I said, it would be nice if we could somehow simplify the gauge structure unification. simplify the flavour structure, you know, do something about the mass generating mechanism. So I think that's a motivation for unification. Of course, it doesn't have to be that way. It could just be that, you know, things are just necessarily untidy. And it's worth remembering that back in the early 1970s, when people started thinking about electroweak unification, they said, well, the most attractive models were the one in which there was a single, simple group describing the electroweak interactions. It turns out that's not the way it works. It's actually SU2 cross U1, right, which is not really a unified theory. Unified in principle, but not unified group symmetry. So it could be the same thing happens at the conjecture grand unification scale. It could be that the SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 come together, and you know, maybe there's an SU5 factor, but maybe it's actually SU5 cross U1, or maybe it's something different. Right? It's a hypothesis that they actually unify. On the other hand, it's incredibly impressive that if you put in the gauge couplings as measured up there, and if you put in supersymmetry at the TV scale, which you want for other reasons anyway, that it happens to unify 2-4 significant figures. That's amazing. Okay. Right. So the answer, of course, is yes. There are, you know, lots of other BSM scenarios that would give you a similar signature. And, for example, any model in which you've got some candidate for dark matter at the TV scale would have an analogous signature, because you could produce those particles, and then those dark matter particles would escape from your detector. And so, for example, there's some extra dimension models where you have Kaluza-Klein excitations, and in some of those models the lightest Kaluza-Klein excitation has a conserved quantum number called K parity, and that can act in many ways the same way as this lightest supersymmetric particle. However, typically the spectrum of the particles in those models is different. I mean, the spectrum of Kaluza-Klein excitations is completely different from what it is in supersymmetry. They have different spins, the mass patterns are different, and so on. So in principle, it would be possible to distinguish it, but it wouldn't be something that you could do immediately. You'd have to work at it. So the scenario for a possible LHC physics discovery would be, after an enormous amount of blood, sweat, and tears, you identified that there is some missing energy signature over and above what you expect from the standard model anyway, in the form of neutrinos. And then it might take actually quite some time, if you have identified such a signature, to verify whether it's supersymmetry or something else. But there are tools for doing that. You can look for angular correlations between particles to see what spins they correspond to, and so on. Model for dark matter that I'm talking about is a model in which the universe is initially some sort of plasma where everything is in thermal equilibrium, and then as it expands and cools, some of those particles drop out of equilibrium and their density gets frozen, in the same way that happens in standard cosmology when baryons get frozen out or light element abundances get frozen out. So that there's a whole calculation scheme which will enable you to calculate the relic density of particles freezing out of that equilibrium. And it depends on the mass of the particle, it depends on the strengths of their interactions, not so much on the strengths of the interactions. It really turns out the mass is the key parameter. And then there is a simple little analytical argument which I'm not capable of reproducing on the hoof, but I can tell you a reference where you can find it, which tells you that that mass is, as I mentioned earlier on, given by the square root of the microwave background temperature times the Planck mass, and that is about a TeV. And that's a very general argument. Now you get various numerical factors coming in depending on how strong the interactions are, how many particles you have in equilibrium, things like that. But TeV is a sort of general prediction of such scenarios. Of course, it's not the only scenario. You can imagine a scenario where the dark matter particles were never in thermal equilibrium. That's what happens with axions, for example, in many scenarios. But if it was in a thermal equilibrium, then there are good reasons to think that the scale would be about a TeV.
By the supersymmetric thing, can you predict some masses of standard model particles so that we can say that those particles we are getting from supersymmetry have same mass or same parameters as we have found experimentally?
Well, I think the only example that I'm aware of which sort of corresponds to what you're suggesting is there are relations between quark and lepton masses that you predict in certain grand unified theories. I'll discuss this, I hope, on Monday. So, for example, there is a prediction in the simplest grand unified theories for the ratio between the tau mass and the bottom mass, which turns out to be approximately correct. Now, this is actually quite an unstable prediction, and in some supersymmetric theories, you could lose the prediction. Conversely, if you could verify the prediction with greater experimental precision, then you could maybe have an interesting constraint on supersymmetric and other theories. But it's a little bit difficult because there are uncertainties in the mass of the bottom quark, and there are other effects that come in. But in principle, that would be one way, I think, of attacking your question.
Okay, so I think we have to stop here. So let's have a go again.